Hey, it's Citizen Cosmos. We're Serge and Anna, and we discover Cosmos by chatting with awesome people from various teams within the Cosmos ecosystem and the community. Join us if you're curious how dreams and ambitions become code.
Calling myself Donald Trump, and that's completely okay.
Do we really need more than just a simple signature? Before we rock it off into our next episode, we would like to share the latest news of this episode's sponsor, Cyber. The Cyber Congress DAO has recently launched its bootloader network for the superintelligence Bostrom. The network is stable and the first IBC connection has been established. More news on the activation of Cyber's gift to follow soon. To test Cyber, head straight to their app on cybe.ai. Good space time to you all. Welcome to a new episode of Citizen Cosmos. We have today with us Ankur Banerjee, the CTO and co-founder of Checked. Ankur, welcome to the show.
Serge, Anna, nice to be on the podcast. I'm very excited to tell you everything about Checked, and I'm sure we'll discover a lot and what we're doing in the Cosmos ecosystem today.
For sure, because you guys kind of appeared, I don't really want to say out of the blue, but it kind of was. You're like, hey, look at us, we're here. And we try to get involved quite deeply within the ecosystem, not just with communities and podcasts, we also validate and do other things. And we haven't heard about you. So if you may, in your own words, tell us all about what you guys do, what's your mission, and anything else you want to add.
Sounds perfect. It does feel like we appeared out of nowhere because Checked as a company, we started around March 2021. And we've had a very rapid pace of product shipping since then. So we'll come to that in a second. But if I needed to summarize it, what we are trying to do at Checked is we are trying to make digital identity cheaper, faster, more secure online. And that comes in many different ways. So there's a concept in the space of digital identity that has been going around the blockchain world called self-sovereign identity, which you might have heard of, or by its other term called SSI. And the reason why Checked exists is me and my co-founder, Fraser Edwards, we've worked in this space for about 5 years at this point on other self-sovereign identity projects for governments, for large enterprises. The one big problem that remains in every single one of these different implementations across the world is how on earth do you monetize this? And that's a major problem that has stopped so many different decentralized ID or blockchain ID or self-sovereign ID, whatever you want to call it, projects from going live. And so at Checked, what we're trying to do is we're trying to, A, bring this into the Cosmos ecosystem and building on the Cosmos ecosystem. But fundamentally, what we're trying to solve is how can we become a neutral network or neutral infrastructure provider that can be used by any digital identity vendor, any SSI vendor, any large enterprise around the world that wants to figure out if any data that they come across is trusted and authentic or not, as well as being able to pay each other for that authentic and trusted data. Lots of stuff to dive into there, but as I said, we got started in March 2021. We had our private beta testnet by July, and we had our public beta testnet by August, and we're hoping to release our mainnet by October 2021.
Nice. That sounds like you guys did a lot of work in a very short period of time. But if you don't mind, I would like to dive a little bit deeper. So let's break it down, like maybe go a few steps backwards. You mentioned digital identity and SSI. And before we're going to dive into that, maybe let's start with the very basics. What is a digital identity in your own terms? And when you say digital identity, what is the difference with the real world identity? Let's start with very basics here.
Digital identity, the easiest way that I explain that is if you think about your real world identity, you can think of documents that exist. You can think of birth certificates. You can think of driving licenses, passports, which are high standard, high security documents that are issued by governments. But it also relates to other things. If you think about the Facebook profile that you might have, a Twitter profile that you might have, you may have a Starbucks card, or like you might have a different sort of ID that you log on to your favorite e-commerce website. All of these different pieces of information are something that relates to you as an individual and therefore forms part of your identity. It's just that some of them tend to be checked to a higher degree by trustworthy organizations. And some of them are whatever you say online. I can sign up a Twitter account, calling myself Donald Trump, and that's completely okay. Like, that's the online persona that I'm going for when I do that. Then move on to like how this translates into what is the idea behind self-sovereign identity. Imagine that you had a driver's license. A driver's license is a document that is issued by a government. It's probably in a plastic format. You hold it in your hand and you can show it. You can carry it around. You can show it to anyone who asks for your driver's license. Now, sometimes you do this to prove that you're allowed to drive, say if you get pulled over by a policeman, or if you go to rent a car, then you use your driver's license. But you also use your driver's license when, say, you go to buy alcohol, or you go out to a nightclub, or you're trying to open up a bank account, and they say, prove to me what is your identity, prove to me what's your name, what address do you live in, what's your date of birth, and so on. So the idea behind digital ID is, imagine you had your driver's license, which is a physical document. What if you could have a secure and digital copy of that, that you hold in your own hands, say in your browser or on your phone or in any other sort of like, you know, storage or backup device that you have, and it's completely in your control. You are able to show it to anyone. And that is what we call self-sovereign digital ID. Because unlike, say, something like a Facebook account, you control and you have full control on like whom you show this identity to and which parts of the identity you want to reveal to them.
So could I try and summarize that the SSI is basically the gateway to my digital data?
Pretty much. And more interestingly, the digital identity doesn't just apply to people. It applies to companies because companies have a registration. They have certain aspects or certifications that they might have. It applies to objects because objects have an identity or certain characteristics that you can capture. Virtual objects also have this. So if you think of the space of NFTs, NFTs have certain attributes and characteristics that make them unique. So that also comes under the category of digital identity. So when we actually start like, you know, teasing into it, it's quite broad. The simplest example is you have a physical driver's license. Wouldn't it be amazing to have a digital copy of it that you can show to others? But when you start expanding that, it applies to companies, objects, things, virtual objects, anything that you can think of.
The reason I'm trying to dig at this is I'm going to try and go around because I really want to hear like an expert's opinion like yourself here on this matter. So a lot of people, when they talk about digital identity, especially in Web3, I don't know if you ever heard the comparison between a digital print and your soul. So people use the internet for 20 or so years. They leave so many of their digital print online that, well, that kind of becomes really a persona by itself already if we take all that information. If we go, you know, like the Cambridge Analytica kind of stuff and all that. So a lot of people who make this comparison, they say that the only real thing we need in order to have a publicly verified digital identity is just a public and a private key, which I can prove by a signature. So what I'm trying to understand here is what are the advantages of having this self-sovereign identity rather than just signing every time with my private key and a signature, some kind of message to prove that I am me.
You're right. I think the way that this started off is by saying you could have a public-private key pair and you sign everything, or you have something like the Ethereum naming system and it says this is a friendly name towards your wallet address and so on. Fundamentally, the problem with that approach, or rather it's an extension like that self-sovereign identity achieves, is when you present some information to someone, how do they understand what the different fields mean? And so to explain that a bit more, this is a industry-wide standard that has been worked on by more than 100 companies and nonprofit groups called the World Wide Web Consortium. And so one of the standards they've created as part of this is called the Decentralized Identifier Standard, which is very similar to what you described. Like it's a way of specifying a public-private key pair that belongs to an organization or to an individual. And how do you store that? But the second piece of this is called verifiable credentials. And verifiable credentials, the idea there is when you present digital information to someone, they need to be able to understand what the different fields mean. So to give an example of this, to go back to my analogy of a driver's license, let's take a UK driver's license. Like the fields in it are quite fixed. So you know that like, you know, field number one means last name, field number two means first name, field number three is date of birth and so on. So when you go present it to somebody else, or even if you go across to a different country and you show that card, they know, ah, okay, so like the first part means this, the second part means this, third part means this, and so on. So if you were just signing some information with the public-private key pair, how do you solve the challenge of when they receive it, can they understand what those different fields mean? And that's one of the things that is being tackled by this self-sovereign ID standard called verifiable credentials. And to take a very real example of, like, you know, where this is actually being used right now, take, for instance, COVID vaccination results or COVID test results when you travel between different countries. So I recently went from the UK to Europe and I had to prove the fact that I was vaccinated in the UK. So I had a digital credential, but when I presented the digital credential to the applications that were being used to read it at the EU border or even just to go to a cafe in Paris, the software on the other side needs to be able to understand what you're presenting to it. So it's an evolution of saying, oh, you can just sign it with a public-private key pair, because at the end of the day, you need to understand what's within it. The second piece is, if you have a public-private key pair that you have published online somewhere, that might result in a scenario where you are leaking whom you're interacting with if it is also being recorded at the same place. So as an example, if you have a public-private key pair that you've named with the Ethereum naming system, and then you make a transfer of like some information or some token or some assets to somebody else, that is now tied and that is now accessible. It's transparent to anyone to follow up. What that means is you might not want whom you're interacting with to be available and be accessible to the general public. So often when we exchange information, we want to keep the fact, whom are we exchanging information with and what kind of information we're exchanging, also quite private. So there are aspects of that which are solved by the self-sovereign ID standards.
This is interesting debate, in my opinion, because I cannot help being devil's advocate here again. So is there a place, though, for standards in a decentralized identity world, or each decentralized identity should decide for itself, because it's a decentralized world, what are the standards it wants to work with, or what is the information it wants to share? I mean, this is a very vague question. I understand where you're coming from. I understand exactly what you're trying to say, but I'm just quite curious, because if we look over the past 10 years or so in the blockchain space of what has been done, especially over the last 5 years in the identity realm, you're right, there hasn't really been many successful projects, but there has been quite several who have tried different approaches. We have like Civic or Urbit or Identa, for example, yourselves guys, and so on and so forth. And each one of them has a very, very, very different approach to solve the solution of the digital identity and how to approach it. So the question is, when you started to create your own model of the SSI, I presume it has its own economical model, which I would love to hear about as well. Did you guys base it on any of the existing models already in blockchain? Or did you look up to any of those projects? Or is it completely something different, new, and unheard of before?
To answer that question, maybe should I explain how like decentralized identifiers and the verifiable credentials actually work? That actually might help answer part of that.
Sure, of course.
So the decentralized ID is interesting and complex topic, because what you fundamentally don't want to do is you don't want to be writing personally identifiable information on a ledger. And the scope of like, you know, how this is interpreted is quite interesting, because a lot of the projects that you just described right now, often what they try to do is they try to either write the information itself or a hash of the information on a ledger. The problem with that particular approach is, at the end of the day, if you want to go remove that information, you cannot. And therefore, according to a lot of the privacy regulations around the world, even a hash of a particular personally identifiable information counts as personally identifiable information, because it still really correlates one-to-one with you, including a public key. So a public key might not have your name on it, but it's still something that is unique to you as an individual, and therefore GDPR applies. So what happens in the decentralized identifier space is, we are not creating necessarily a new standard. The standards themselves are technical standards, and there are about 100 plus decentralized identifier methods, as they're called, around the world. So we are doing it in compliance with those specifications. And how it works is, with the decentralized identifier standard, it is meant to be a way in which organizations that issue or verify information typically can publish their public-private key pair and API endpoints to the services that they run. And the reason why decentralized identifiers, which is the bit that you store on a ledger on a blockchain, is typically meant to be for organizations is because organizational data does not come under the scope of GDPR. Now, what happens with the next phase, which is how do you then issue credentials off the back of it, is the credentials themselves are off ledger. They are not recorded on a blockchain. They don't have any aspects of them written to a blockchain, but they're signed with the public-private key pair or the identifiers that are stored on a DID, as they're called, or the decentralized identifier of a particular trusted organization. And what this achieves is the actual information doesn't have to be stored on a blockchain. It can be transmitted peer-to-peer between two parties that want to exchange that information while ensuring that the recipient of that information can easily look up, hey, who issued this information and who signed it in the first place? What's quite unique about the decentralized identifier standard is it doesn't mention that like you have to store it on a blockchain. So for instance, when I mentioned there's 100 plus standards for DID methods, one of them is called DID GitHub and the other one is called DID Web, which basically means you store the public-private key pair or the DID on a website or on a GitHub account. The problem with that approach is if that website goes down or if the hosting provider says, we are going to delete your website, or if GitHub says, you violate our terms and conditions, then they can go remove that. So the element of like trust that a blockchain is adding is it's adding a high amount of resiliency. So you don't rely on a single provider. And you're also adding in a high amount of tamper-proofing, which is a random person cannot go and overwrite that information unless you own the public-private key pair. The challenge that I've seen with a lot of the blockchain OID projects, and in fact, this is one of the reasons why we are making certain sort of like technical and ideological choices, is many of the projects that have come so far, because in most other blockchain use cases, you try and write every single information onto the ledger, they try and write the information onto a ledger. And that is one of the things you're not supposed to do in the identity use case because it's a privacy leak. It does not comply with privacy regulations around the world. And fundamentally, therefore, is incompatible with some of the technical and legal standards around this that are happening around the world. So what are we doing different is we are following the technical specifications, and that's the bit which is common with the rest of the industry. It's meant to be an interoperable standard. But what we are doing that is quite unique is we are building in the mechanisms to charge for these digital credentials that are off-ledger using an on-ledger mechanism.
So these DIDs, are they stored in the form of a contract or a token, or what is it?
These DIDs are essentially stored as states on a ledger. So, and in most DID methods, what happens is you store it in the same way that it might have like a wallet address or an account address on a ledger.
Can you give an example to use case, a simple of where you guys come in with a potential imaginary customer?
I'll take a real example of like one of our partners and investors called Evanim, who are currently building the IATA Travel Pass program. So IATA is the International Air Transport Association. It's the global industry body for every single airline around the world. And the problem that they were trying to solve with COVID, the pandemic that happened last year, is how can people easily carry across and prove their COVID test results and COVID vaccinations? Number one, you don't want to create a global database of everyone's single health records. That's a terrible idea. And secondly, you don't want to integrate with 192 different countries, different health record systems. So how can we go about solving this problem? What we try to do, for example, with self-sovereign ID is to say, hey, people right now are having to prove this using just PDFs or printed like, you know, letters that they're carrying around, which can easily be faked, which can easily be lost, which are not very secure and reliable as a mechanism of exchange. And so what a lot of the countries around the world have started looking at this, so the European Union is doing this, some of the other sort of like, you know, nation states like the UK is looking into this as well, is to say, when you get a COVID test or a COVID vaccination done, you have a decentralized identifier or a DID of the country's either the health system or the hospital or the test lab that issued your result. They have a DID or an identifier or a public-private key pair for themselves on a blockchain. They issue you, the person who's the traveler, the test results into a wallet that you can keep the records in. and that says, this is a digitally signed and tamper-proof copy of your vaccination or your test results. So when you fly to a different country and you go across and you have to prove to them that I have this test result, it's digitally readable, you can understand what is contained in the records, and you also prove that it's not been tampered. And the way they check that is they check the signature at the bottom of this digital credential, and they can look it up on a blockchain. Because it's on a blockchain, it's easily accessible. It doesn't rely on a single person's uptime or a single person's like censorship of whether this record is still available or not. But that's a fantastic example of a real life use case, which is happening right now. And while they are currently not using Checked, our partner Evanim has just gone live with Emirates Airlines. And Emirates Airlines is using this on every single flight that is taking off and landing in 6 different continents. And it's very powerful because what you've just done is you've made data that can be trusted, and it is portable across different contexts and different countries.
First of all, thank you for the really thoughtful explanation. That makes a lot more sense. But let's dig in a little bit more. So the thing is here, and what a lot of the privacy advocates and a lot of Web3 builders that we speak to personally, just generally around the industry, a lot of them are afraid, is that a lot of the time, what some projects might do is basically just transfer data back to encrypted, kind of transfer it, and then still work with Web2 and still basically create, even expand that bureaucratic loop even more in some cases. Like you said yourself, you gave a very good example of how it can be used. But I was going to say the first thing was not to start the pandemic, but let's say it's in place already, right? And the bats are flying out of Wuhan or whatever the reality is there. But the question is, again, do we really need more than just a simple signature to prove? If let's say that I would personally agree with the COVID test results, I mean, let's ignore for a second everything that surrounds the story with, is it a good thing, is it a bad thing? Let's just assume that we need to do a COVID test in order to travel, and that's our given A, whatever. So I'll explain it from a different point of view. In my opinion, email is one of the most outdated technologies. It's absolutely useless. It's hopeless. It's crap. It's bullshit. There is like nothing it can be used for. Though still, 99%, 0.99% of Web2 companies, they are using email in order to create an unnecessary database, just creating holes. So again, I'm being devil's advocate here. So my worry is, or not my worry, or rather my question is, by creating those standards in the decentralized world, are we just not pushing the Web2 bureaucratic loop together to Web3? Or really, the reason why I was saying, well, all we need is just a private and a public key, and that's it. Somebody might want like a big airline company other data. The question is, do they really need their data? Well, no, they fucking don't. So does anybody really need my email in order for me to log into GitHub? Not really. Does anybody need my date of birth in order for me to get a driving license? No, not really. I mean, they might need to know what year I was born at, but they don't need my date of birth. So the question is here, whether this complicates it more, or whether the opposite, what you guys are doing, is actually trying to standardize, like you said, a very big piece of a puzzle and saying, okay, we do need that. The reason we do need it is A, B, C, D. Or do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, and I'm very glad you brought that point up, actually, because you're absolutely right. The traditional way that you prove stuff right now goes towards maximizing and capturing everything. Like, so for instance, there are times when I've been gone traveling in Asia and the first thing you do at check-in is like, give me your passport, I'll keep a photocopy. You've just literally given somebody the entire stuff they need to go steal your identity. So one of the other things that exists in the SSI standards is the ability to redact and only selectively disclose information. So the way that these technical standards are built is you allow for selective disclosure. So for instance, like you, the example that he gave, when you go in to buy alcohol, all they need to know is that you're above the age of 18 and that has been vouched for by a trusted authority.
It's also a good question. Do they know to need that I'm over 18, or is this another unnecessary piece of like, but let's stick with the story. I like it.
You can be a maximalist libertarian on like what data is required or not, but I'll come to the DeFi examples in a second. Give a very real example of this. For instance, my girlfriend does not update her address on her driver's license because she's worried that if she goes to a nightclub to prove her age is above 18, you've just given a random bouncer the address that you live at. So the way that in which we currently prove trust in a lot of these different contexts is broken, because you often have to reveal way too much information than you need to. And so one of the big parts while the decentralized ID movement has been working on is how can you do selective disclosure and how can you reduce the amount of information that you need to reveal to someone. Now, the reality is that even when you look at a lot of the laws around the real world, like say you need to go open up a bank account, say you need to open a centralized exchange account, say you need to open up an account on Coinbase, often what you have to go through is something called the KYC process, the Know Your Customer process. The insane part of this is, like in the process of setting up a company, I've had to take a selfie, a picture of my passport, and provide God knows how many PDFs to 8 or 10 different times, just within navigating the crypto and the DeFi system. Now, one challenge on that could be, hey, actually, we don't need all of that. And that's a bit more of a political point on what should be the regulations within the crypto industry of how identity is verified. But to flip that around to within the decentralized space itself, like, can we go beyond just the public-private key pair? So for instance, when we got some investment into a company, it was done through as a USDC transfer. Now, the reality is, because that's a public-private key pair, right? You're sending to a particular account address. But when we are transferring large amounts, how do you know that the person on the other side is the real person that you are transferring to? How do you know that it's not a scammer? So often what we needed to do is we needed to get on a Zoom call, show my face, screen share, and show I had control of a wallet. And we see this so many different times, especially when you're doing high-value crypto transfers. You do a test transfer, and then somebody checks it's okay, and then you send a screenshot back, or you get on a Zoom call. So what you're doing is you're proving the act of like, yes, it's actually me on the other side, and I still control this.
But in theory, you could have just signed the message, and that's it.
You would not do that if you were sending 200K. Right?
Why not? Why not?
You wouldn't send 200K across and be like, well, that's gone now. And I know it's actually definitely going to Anchor.
Do I need to know, though, it's going to you? Do I need to know that it's going to Anchor? Or do I just need to know that it's going to the address of your company? If you can guys sign the message we're using the private key, send it to me saying, this is us. Again, this is like a really philosophical debate.
Yeah, absolutely. So what you're describing actually, and this is often what gets confused when people say digital identity, because it means many things. What you're describing is called authentication, which is what is it that I can do given this public-private key pair, and is it signed by the right thing? But being signed by the right public-private key pair doesn't necessarily mean it belongs to that specific person. To give a good example of this, my phone is currently locked with Face ID or Touch ID, or you may use similar, and that is also effectively a public-private key pair. But a lot of people register like their spouses or their children on their phone with, say, Touch ID. So when a phone is unlocked and a public-private key pair is provided to a crypto app, that doesn't necessarily mean it's you specifically, the actual legal owner or the person who has control of it that is actually using it. So that is authentication. And it's quite an important one that you brought up. Like if you sign something with a public-private key pair, the way that you deal with it in high-value context is sometimes you have multi-signatures and you say, actually, let's not just rely on one signature. Let's do 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The other thing, and this is the bit that we focus on, and this is the bit that self-sovereign identity often focuses on, is who am I? Not the bit like, you know, what am I allowed to do? But the first part, which is who am I? What are my identity attributes? And what does that allow me to do? And that's quite a powerful one where I think DeFi can come disrupt the world. Because fundamentally, if you think about it, like the reason why there's so much financial inclusion that doesn't happen around the world is because you are relying on a system where people don't have paper documents, people don't have government issued documents to do a number of different things. And the act of checking those documents, often in the Web 2.0 world, and or even the on-ramp onto the Web 3.0 worlds, costs a lot of money to do. So we can ignore it, or we can actually face the fact that, like, you know, there's a part of, like, you know, verification of who am I and what are the different attributes that matters. Now, specifically in that context where you said, like, well, that's just the address that somebody gave and it was signed by the company, it did matter because what they were doing is they were making an investment. And so they expect something in return. So if you hadn't really checked that it was going to the right entity, you just invested in the wrong company.
I'm still unsure why wouldn't a signature prove to the people that was their entity. But thank you for that explanation. I think it's a very good example of looking at those two different points of view, where on one point of view, you have like the what you're saying with the standardization and trying to actually make some sense of all the big pieces of data and saying, okay, guys, let's do it. Let's not just encrypt it, hash it, this piece of data, but let's, like you say, create an SSI with the IDs and with a whole economy system behind it. And I guess the other side, we have like the cypherpunk side, which say, well, all these people who, like you mentioned with the documents, they only need those documents because the system is fucked up and unnecessarily way. But anyways, this is a good, interesting debate, I think. And it's great that you guys are really trying to do something in order to make some order in it. But let's maybe talk a little bit about your role. And you're the CTO and the co-founder. And what's your role as the CTO in the project? And how do you see your personal role? Like, what's your goal, your personal goal as a CTO?
My personal goal as CTO is, I think at the end of the day, I almost call them religious debates or zealot debates. And we literally just had one, by the way, that happened sort of like, you know, within the blockchain space, right? I think fundamentally what I'm quite interested in is like, you know, what is the impact that the technology is having? Huge amounts of what happens in the decentralized ID world so far, by the way, has not even touched crypto or happened in the crypto space. Like, most of it was done on a project called Hyperledger Indy, which is by far the biggest standard right now on which decentralized ID is handled right now. So what I am quite interested in is, like, you know, not just looking at like a technical debate on which platform is better, like why should we use Checked over like the other ones, but what we want to enable is, there's 100 different, like, you know, technical standards. That's fine. And that's actually really good. The same way that there are like 100 different email clients. Perfect. Email is interoperable. Anybody can go create a standard. That's okay. But what we want to differentiate ourselves on is, when you have these digital credentials, how does the individual that holds that information, how do they get compensated for the access that they're giving to other people? How do the trusted organizations that issue these credentials get compensated for the fact that, like, you know, they've just given an individual an identity? And what I mean by that, and why personally this really matters to me, is I think we can fundamentally change and disrupt the cost of proving who am I in the digital world. And if we can fundamentally disrupt the cost of proving who am I, whether that as an individual or a company, I think that, like, you know, massively expands a lot of different access to DeFi products. It makes NFTs more accessible. It makes DEXs more accessible. It makes DAOs a lot easier to sort of, you know, control in the real world or in the Web 2.0 world as well. It gives a much more private, more secure, and more in control of the individual way of sharing information. And if we can get to that, like, you know, that's fantastic. Ultimately, the reason why we are doing a lot of the stuff around how we want to govern our network as well is, we don't think a single company should control such critical infrastructure on the web of, like, how information is exchanged, unlike the Web 2.0 world. That's sort of, like, you know, what really gets me out of bed. It's the fact that, like, you know, can we make the act of, like, you know, proving trusted and authentic data a lot more cheaper, a lot more accessible, a lot more secure, a lot more private, as well as ensuring that at the end of the day, it's something that's quite democratic and owned by the people.
Can you remember at which point of your life or career you decided that authenticating data is really important to you? Was that some kind of an event that led to it, or some kind of good event, bad event, or maybe it wasn't an event at all?
My personal way I got into this is, I got into one of the first sort of like SSI projects, which was about offering identity to refugees. And this was as a follow-up to the Syrian refugee crisis. One of the first times that refugees were quite geographically mobile and they were moving across quite a lot of different European countries. If you move countries, you probably have to sign up with 25 different government agencies. Now, that's a perfect example where you can go off, like, do we really need to sign up with 25 different agencies, and is this required or not? But at the end of the day, they had to get access to benefits, to get access to support. And what none of the governments wanted to do at that time is to create, like, one giant database that holds the information of every single refugee. That was seen as a privacy risk that nobody really wanted to do. And especially given the history in Europe with World War II of, like, you know, how databases of populations got used. So one of the first projects that I worked on was how could we have a digital ID that could be backed up, is completely in control of the individual or the refugees, that they can securely and privately share without necessarily having to try and sign up every single time from scratch. And especially in a context where they might not be able to easily phone home and say, hey, can I get a copy of my birth certificate? That was the first sort of like an entry into looking at like, you know, wow, okay, this could actually be transformative in how information gets handled. And what I've done since then is like I've increasingly gotten involved in other projects like this, where access to authentic information can genuinely change lives. And yeah, it's been a topic of interest ever since.
It sounds like it's a mixture of like world problems and like a personal take, which is really good, I guess, where founders are motivated by something personal rather than trying to chase only the technology or only like some kind of value.
Could you imagine that you do something else now? And if you can imagine that, what it would be? Not having this particular project on being involved into keeping personal data, what kind of project it could be?
Do you want just like a personal goal or a personal hobby instead of like a technical thing? Or what do you mean?
Yeah, sure, sure. You know, for me, what you do in your project, you put the part of your own personality into the project. And every single project is actually about founders. And then after the next generation, the project in our decentralized world become more and more decentralized and start to meet the interests and the personality of the community. Yeah, it's a process of involving the people who have the same vibe. So in order to understand what kind of vibe you have, I want to ask you who you are. Apart from being a person who are interested into the good understanding of what happened with your personal data, what else you inspired by? What can you do rather than that particular project in your life?
What inspires me is the fact that like I grew up living across a lot of different countries when I was growing up, living across Southeast Asia, India, Thailand, Singapore, a couple of other places as well. And a lot of my immediate family, as well as others, often work in diplomatic or government or civil services. For instance, looking into being the first people responding to a natural disaster, or working for the Electoral Commission, or working for the railway systems. So I've actually had first-hand experience looking at what not just access, not just decentralized ID or blockchain, but just access to technology. And by technology, I mean a hand pump that supplies water is technology as far as I'm concerned. Just even access to the internet, how that has changed things in the past 30 years that I've been alive. So that's what motivates me. I think if I wasn't doing decentralized ID or blockchain, I would still probably be working on something that was around impact and accessibility to for people who have less. And I know I'm probably sounding a bit blockchain can solve all of the world's problems, founders that we have seen so many of in the past sort of like I say 10 years. But I wouldn't necessarily just be focused on doing it with blockchain. The other sort of like, you know, thing that really, really sort of like interests me is teaching and mentoring people. Like it's something that I genuinely enjoy. I love going to hackathons. I love looking at new people who are getting into, say, the tech industry or other industries and looking at how can I best support their careers? How can I best support them learning new skills? So that gets me sort of really excited as well. And I'd say, as a team, like a lot of us within the team connected across very, very similar mission and values on why are we here? Yes, we are here to make a successful project. Yes, we want it to be commercially sustainable. But at the end of the day, we want to make sort of like do really impactful stuff as well.
Do you think that the impact you guys are bringing will affect just Cosmos or the whole industry? Or what are you aiming at?
I think it's beyond Cosmos as well, because Cosmos so far hasn't really had a decentralized ID standard or a lot of projects on decentralized ID. And I would say the same thing applies for a lot of different other blockchain frameworks as well. And the reality is most of the work that has happened in this space so far has been in Hyperledger Indy. So in a way, almost, we are working towards winning over people who use different platforms and standards. And in every single conversation that I've had so far, when I've gone around explaining, like, you know, why we didn't build on Hyperledger, indeed started building on Cosmos, even though mine and Fraser's personal experience has been in the past building on other SAN platforms like Hyperledger indeed. When we explain, like, you know, hey, this is why we're doing it, it's public permissionless, it's a lot more scalable than what you've been used to in the past, there's a lot more, a wider ecosystem of, like, you know, developers and software support and things like exchanges, wallets. When we go explain all of that, it's like we absolutely get it. So fundamentally, I think the impact of, like, you know, what we are trying to do goes far beyond A, just in terms of the blockchain and the tech industry. I think it goes beyond the Cosmos ecosystem. But secondly, this is one of the few use cases where most of the information is not on a chain. Like 99% of the action is happening off chain. And because 99% of the action is happening off chain, it is by definition not just impacting the Cosmos ecosystem. It is a question of what does this fundamentally get used to prove in either the real world or in the digital world in many different contexts.
As I understand, you've feel better when you help people, when you do something for others. And it's like a general line that with you during all what you're doing, actually. Am I correct?
I would completely agree with that. I think any sort of technology that is being built always should look at, like, you know, what is the impact on the user? Like, I got into technology in a really weird way. I really didn't even want to get into software engineering. My parents wanted me to be an artist, and I decided to rebel against that. And that's why I chose computer science. I thought that would be the thing that would piss them off the most. Probably the opposite of what Asian people go through. But because I come from, I guess, a background, like, you know, where I studied art for many years, studied economics, communications, I really enjoy looking at the intersection of technology and a lot of other things. And part of that is, why build technology for the sake of it when you're not really looking at, like, you know, what sort of, like, you know, real world impact this has on people? What I'd love to have is people use this tech that we are building without even having to learn what is blockchain, without even having to learn what is SSI. SSI itself is a very complicated term. You wouldn't, like, you know, chat about that at a pub with your mates. I do.
We do too. It's okay.
But you know what I mean? Something truly becomes wide-ranging and adopted when you don't have to really explain it. It just works.
Of course.
Yeah. I do chat about SSI or blockchain, or a lot of tech stuff around the pub with my mates, but technology, like, really becomes adopted when nobody talks about it. That is the point where it's like, you've really made it. Nobody is talking about it at this point. That's when it's become really, really fundamentally adopted and made an impact.
I think that's a very good summary point of, regardless of the views of whatever it is you do, if your technology that you're creating is coming from the perspective of bringing good and the market is adopting it, I guess then, well, you're doing something good for the market, right? I guess somehow that hour really flew by, which means we had a really good, how you said, religious debate. Before we let you go, though, I would love to ask, like, our traditional question. This could be anything that springs to your mind. Doesn't matter if the answer is going to be a book or something to do or a podcast or a GitHub page or whatever. Could you share some of the resources that motivate you in your daily life, like day to day? Maybe it's a book, like I said, maybe it's a game, maybe it's, I don't know, walking around the forest, whatever it is you think you would like to share with everyone.
Sure. But the thing that sort of, like, really motivates me and I think has defined the way a lot of people see me is we're called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I, in fact, even have this tattooed. I have 42 tattooed on my arm. I think a lot of references that end up happening around me do somehow go back to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So if you haven't heard of it, just go on Google or search engine of your choice. I'm DuckDuckGo. Why not? And search for, like, the answer to life, the universe, and everything. And you'll get a very confusing answer. And then maybe just go read the book. What's fascinating about it is, like, the author, Douglas Adams, he deliberately made it a different story in every medium that it is in. And so I've seen the TV show, the play, the radio show, the books, the movie. Like, there's a text-based adventure game that you can also go find. And, like, it's a different story in all of them. So it's quite exciting. I'd say definitely go do that. But if you want to learn something about SSI, there's a book called literally called Self-Sovereign ID. You can go look it up. It's by Alex Prokshat and Drummond Reed. Drummond Reed is one of the early pioneers of Self-Sovereign ID, also an advisor to our company and has been working with us. And so if you want to find out more about that, you can also find that online.
Thank you. We will definitely include the link to the book and the link to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. On that note, so long and thanks for all the fish, for the people who understood that you've definitely watched or read it. If you haven't, do that. It's a great guide to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. That's what it's called. That's what it's about. Anchor, it's been a huge pleasure talking to you. It's been a huge pleasure hearing about what you guys do. I'm hoping we will hear more about you guys in the ecosystem now that you guys came out of the shadow. And thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for this mostly harmless chat.
We try to be harmless, but we need to get the answers. Thanks, everybody, for joining in.
Thanks, Serge. Thanks, Anna.